Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman.
Gene Gendel is an organizational design specialist, an agile lean coach and trainer, consultant and advisor to senior leadership. 20 plus years of professional experience, Gene is dedicated to working with companies of various sizes and lines of business, trying to help them to improve internal dynamics, organizational structure, and becoming a better place to work. Gene engages at all organizational levels, senior, mid-level teams and individuals, and in his work, Gene uses various methods, tools, and techniques to amplify learning by others and to ensure that people gain autonomy after Gene coaches himself out of a job, so to speak. Gene is a certified Agile coach by Scrum Alliance, a small elite community of Scrum Alliance certified enterprise coaches. And today he's the only CEC who resides in New York State. Gene is also one of the creators of Team Level Coaching Certifications CTC program for Scrum Alliance. Gene is also one of the very few certified less coaches and certified less trainers globally, one of the very few that are based in the United States. The biggest, most active and growing less New York City community, pushing towards 5,000 people at the moment, has been built by Gene. Gene Gendel, welcome to the Exagility podcast. How are you doing today?
John Coleman, it's a pleasure being here. Thank you for inviting me. I'm good. Thank you for having me here.
Delighted. Really keen to hear lots about your experience with large-scale Scrum, known as LESS for short. But before we get into that, Gene, I'm just wondering, how did you get into Agile in the first place?
A bunch of waterfall PMP salesmen sold it to me. No, I'm just kidding. The agility to me really didn't come as the, oh, look, there's something else you can do. Let's just switch gears and try something new. It was so natural. Partially was driven by personal frustration and dissatisfaction, including personal dissatisfaction with what I have seen around myself for years, looking at traditional legacy ways of managing efforts and people, humans, individuals, was really not to my liking. It gave me a cringeworthy feeling. So I was just doing my own reading and my own probing, thinking and seeing what else could be out there that's different from the current. I also come from some personal background of athletics. So to me, the word agility, as in adaptiveness, wasn't really something that I associated with hardware, software development. But then when I mapped the two, I felt natural. It wasn't really the thing that I pursued or wanted to become an agilist. It's just something that naturally filled in the gap, little vacuum that I have created for myself by not liking and not feeling to be a part of the big mainstream of traditional project managers, program managers, portfolio managers of managers, and just the traditional legacy corporate America, if you will. So in a nutshell.
Thank you, Gene. Is it difficult actually to get people to embrace agility in the United States? So what's it like culturally for people to accept the idea of empowered teams and all that kind of stuff?
So first, I would like to make one comment here. I try not to use the word agile or agility as much as I can. I use the word adaptiveness, adaptive. These are synonymous words, and they actually have a history going back to 2001 Agile Manifesto. The words adaptiveness and adaptive are more naturally understood by a layperson. So now it becomes a question how receptive people are to becoming more adaptive, being more nimble, being more responsive, reactive to changes, being able to turn on a dime for a dime. I'm not sure if it's based on geography, although I would tend to believe that in the United States, because of the traditional legacy corporate world has been around for decades and for generations, it is probably more difficult, especially if you are in a large fintech sector or pharmaceutical or insurance, where legacy traditional processes and roles and protocols have been in existence for decades. It is more challenging for startup companies, for smaller product-centric companies, Silicon Valley type of companies, it would be more natural. The United States is just a huge marketplace in general. So there are compartments, different areas where adaptiveness and agility are more natural and less so.
Yeah. Sounds similar to Europe, actually, what you said, organizations with a long history of bureaucracy and rules, and sometimes where rules are in place and people even forget why the rules are there and they become replaced with checklists and things like that.
Anti-agility and anti-adaptiveness, anti, are more synonymous with bureaucracy and legacy and procedural overhead. And that's more consistent with layered, complex, heavily scaled organizations.
You just mentioned scaling there, which is a lovely segue into large-scale Scrum, also known as LESS. I remember giving you a talk about LESS, I think it was in 2014, and someone in the audience said, you're talking about LESS. I didn't know what the gentleman was talking about because I didn't know the acronym existed. They put a little E in the middle, didn't they, LSS, and went from there. It's been around for well over 10 years. Not sure how long it's been around, to be honest, but I'm curious how you got into LESS.
So if I may just make a slight modification to the years, and this is probably not a trivial point. It has been around for more than plus. So if we think of the journey, as people have got to know LESS as a framework, quote unquote, I think it's 2015 when it saw the daylight, the website was published, and the third LESS book was published. We called the Green Book number 3. However, book number 1 and book number 2, they respectively, they were written in 2009 and 10. So more than a decade ago, more than a decade prior to 2015. Now, a book is written based on lots of experiments ran and experiences collected. So another decade prior to that of informal information gathering, experiments, failures, successes, case studies, first adoption attempts have been made. So the journey is pretty long, extensively long, something that no other commercially successful framework can claim because they never thought of it back then. This was a natural journey by a bunch of early starters to improve a large scale, multi-side product development. The framework was never the goal. Selling the framework was never the goal, has never been the goal. Even today, it's not the goal. So product-centric multi-site product development was really just the meat and potatoes there. So there were 600 plus experiments collected over the decades. And so the journey is pretty long. I wrote both books in 2011. But prior to that, my heart was towards this unorthodox ways of working. Unorthodox if you take traditional legacy organizational dynamic as an orthodox way of working. Mine was unorthodox. So it felt very natural to me. There was so much I read in those books. It was like, oh man, that makes sense. And then I obviously met Craig and Bas Vody and learned a bunch of great stuff from them. Craig has been my personal mentor for many years. So I can't imagine now like how much stuff I learned from him personally. So that was really not a flip of a switch, like a binary. Okay, now you start doing LESS. It was a gradual thing for me. And then many experiments that were captured in LESS, in the LESS books, were almost identical to what I would love to do otherwise. Oh, someone actually was way ahead of me and much better, much more experienced than me. They already documented this.
Follow-up question would be, is LESS a framework? Because it's based on principles, insofar as I can see. I think the rules are useful because if you have something that's purely principle-based, people don't know what to do. So having some rules, I think, can be useful. And there's a kind of a minimal set of rules there. But what's your view? Is LESS a framework?
So a couple of things. First, a large-scale Scrum, if you really want to formally state it, it is a framework. It is a very light, adaptive framework that combines in itself simplicity and elegance of one team Scrum, but also helps us amplify the goodness of one team Scrum while working in a larger and, of course, involving more than just one team. So from that perspective, it's very consistent and I would say very aligned with what we appreciate from the elegance of one team Scrum. But what large-scale Scrum really makes an emphasis on is the organizational design and system dynamics that are typically not explicitly paid attention to if you just adopt one team, what's called simple, a basic Scrum. Because organizational design and structure must be, will be inevitably fundamental. I don't want to use the word radically, fundamentally changed if we wanted to build a product-centric, customer-focused organization with the system optimizing goal in mind, being organizational adaptiveness, aka agility. And so that's what LESS would be. And one of the biggest misnomers out there, especially when it comes to large organizations like banks, pharmaceutical, insurance companies, oh, we're big, we need to scale. What's the framework that helps us scale? You must be out of your mind if you approach this from the perspective you need to scale. That's probably the least thing you need to do. You need to think of how to descale yourself, how to remove complexity, how to simplify yourself, how to make your structure simpler, leaner, more nimble. So large-scale Scrum essentially, and that's why even in my training and coaching, I almost trivialize the label, the logo less. I mentioned this, of course, in the past, and people know where they are, but I stress the importance of organizational design and system thinking and system modeling that we stress heavily emphasizing less. Because in order to scale goodness, let's just say one team Scrum, if we consider Scrum being a good thing for product development, in order to scale goodness of that, we need to descale organizational complexity, delayer, flatten, simplify, not make it completely flat, but flatter than how you found it. And this is why we see so many organizations getting it wrong. They think that you can just unpack and install something like class on the existing organizational structure without changing it. Looking for ways, how can map our existing legacy language to less language? And you can't. You can't put a square peg into a round hole and expect it's going to fit. You see levels, layers, or orthodox structures. If you really want to legalize that under the umbrella of agility, quote unquote, then look for something else that is more consistent with your current organizational design. And most likely with some legacy tooling structures that you have in place. And I can guarantee you there is at least one framework out there that would be very successful if you want to just unpack and install and align with the current org structure, because it's designed to make you feel good. But less isn't it. It will make you feel extremely uncomfortable if you were to try to put the very thin and tight leggings, the stockings, if it didn't fit you. So you really have to think of your organizational health and organizational structure.
Thanks, Gene. You reminded me of a briefing from the Oxford Review a few weeks ago where they were talking about the topic of sense-making. And they used a metaphor of a little puddle of water, and we're in the puddle of water. And there's another tiny droplet of water away from the puddle that's kind of over there. And the metaphor you use, that if you're sense-making, what you're doing is you leave your puddle to have a look at what's in that little drop to try and make sense of it and see how does it tie in with your experiences and so on. And then you try to make sense of it in terms of how do you change your thinking as a result of that. But what I notice is that with a lot of people, they don't have the ability to sense-make. They just want to translate the drop that they see outside the puddle in their own language, and then just you're essentially metaphorically just moving the deck chairs in the Titanic, relabeling everything, not really authentically trying to achieve any adaptiveness. And that's what I wanted to dig into you next about in terms of the case studies for less. There's lots of frameworks out there for descaling and for scaling. Descaling as in simplifying, scaling as in making things bigger. And of course, one of the first routes of scaling is not to scale, to get the best people together to do the right job. But if you had to pick one, what would you look at? And so each of these frameworks have case studies, but a lot of them are like sales and marketing oriented. No disrespect to people in sales and marketing, but very much about the messaging, not so much about what really happened and how much rigor was there in getting that case study checked out. And I'm just wondering, what's the situation in the less community? What happens with a case study? Because you're a certified Scrum trainer, I understand, and you had to submit a case study. What was the process you had to go through? And what's the typical process that a case study has to go through before it gets published on the less website?
Well, if this is the question mostly about the process and the mechanics of becoming a less trainer, it's actually pretty visible. There's a full transparency. Of course, you need to be engaged for a while in less adoptions. It doesn't matter if it's successful or unsuccessful, as far as I'm concerned, but you really have to be a part of those learning journeys and to be learning firsthand. Obviously, if you have some success stories to tell, it's great. But no less importantly, learning about lack of thereof, something I'm going to allude to in a second, because when you say PR or case studies for marketing, less case studies are totally not for that. But in order to become a less trainer, of course, you need to read all three books. You need to do lots of self-advanced, self-guided, self-paced learning, as I mentioned, hands-on experience. And every less trainer is first and foremost an experienced less coach, which obviously with territory comes your ability to coach. So that's something that you can, it doesn't necessarily have only have to be less. You should be a great coach, a capability builder, an enabler, someone who can demonstrate an array of coaching, facilitation, enablement tools, but of course around and about less also. So you need to be very savvy with less. So that's just as far as the journey. And of course the case study itself, I never intended to become a trainer, quite frankly. Craig Larman actually motivated me a lot by saying, no, if you're writing a case study, which I wanted to do only, just to write a case study, said, you're going all the way. And I actually, I don't regret I did this, because now it gave me a great opportunity to teach in a way that people seem to be really liking and they get inspired. So that's just my personal little thing. But it would go through many rounds of reviews with a mentor. And I had a great mentor as well, Jorgen de Schmet from Belgium. And then it goes through Bas Vody, one co-founder of Less, and then Craig Larman. And it finally finds its way on the Less.work site. It's extremely important. And I don't think you were asking this, but I'll say this anyway. A large-scale Scrum has case studies out there, but these are not PR'd or promoted or propelled by a company itself to create an illusion of front and back success. If you read any one of those case studies, they will be, first of all, very thorough, very deep. And they're written by people from the trenches on the ground, living and breathing those studies. You will find healthy balance between successes and failures. And on both ends, you would hear and you would be able to read lots of the whys behind. So those are great learning opportunities for those that even try, if you want to try to consider less. It's perfectly fine for someone to learn less and say, you know what, it ain't for me. I'm not going to fly on fumes of less because it's too rocky, too dangerous for me and for my organization. So I would actually be very keen on educating people on this. Less case studies are not for sale or promotion. Unlike if you take a typical case study written, let's say, by a large consultancy, and I will not be dropping the names here, but I think you can read between the lines. The fancy ones, the famous ones, they talk about great success stories, great improvements and achievements. I would actually be extremely skeptical about those. And I have personally challenged and try to validate some of those by talking to those very companies that those case studies were written about. And they said, this is totally inflated. This is totally not reflective of reality. But yet there were great marketing promotion tools because one hand washes another. Did you ever see a large company blaming itself for a failure of agile transformation when it was driven by a large consultancy based on some of the success case studies that they've had? I'm yet to find a case like this.
Yeah, sometimes I still hear people saying that they dream about bringing in some of these consulting firms. They'll just do everything and it's less difficult. Yeah, it's a tricky situation. It feels like a merry-go-round. It's encouraging to hear that it sounds like the case studies on the Less website, they go through some form of rigor, not really about marketing, not really about promotion. It's more about this is what really happened from a learning point of view.
That's a true statement. That's a very true statement. Those are very rigorously validated and very frequently reviewed. And so, yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about what kind of readiness does an organization need to be thinking about less? I mean, some people talk about we need a certain level of consciousness. Other people would say we need to be at a certain level of agility before we can even think about using less. What's your view on that?
I am going to say this. I wouldn't necessarily think that you need a certain degree of organizational maturity to start learning about less. There are certainly books out there, case studies, and almost in any organization, you can find people that would be willing to read and learn for themselves. Now, as far as less adoption or an attempt to make some efforts in the dimension of less adoption, I think what's very important is to bring on board, and sooner rather than later, I would say at the very early stage, senior executive, the senior echelon, people that are in charge of organizational design, C-level people, plus minus two from the CIO, depending how big you and how complex the org structure is. Less adoptions require looking into such dimensions as HR norms and policies, budget and finance, site strategies, and other important dimensions that cannot be simply controlled or impacted by people on the ground, team level. So you absolutely need those executives to be fully bought into a less adoption experiment and not supported just in spirit and slogans and budgeting and funding. Hey, if it's $50 million, go bring a large consultancy, they'll do it for you. None of that. We need the money, of course, but more so we need their support at Gemba where action takes place. So they actually need to roll up their sleeves and be involved. And for that, they need to learn. So I don't think you need a specific degree of organizational maturity to start adopting less. You certainly need to have a bunch of intellectuals, humans that are willing to learn, and also they need to be empowered humans. And there is more to say on how we adopt less, deep and narrow versus broad and shallow, top, bottom, and bottom up, by volunteering. Those are less adoption principles. But you certainly need to educate as many people as you can up front, define a product
because less is for product-centric development. And of course, you need to make sure that senior executives are really involved from the very beginning.
Yeah, and I'd imagine there might be some challenges where there's a project mindset, because you mentioned less is about product. Because I had an interview with Bruce McCarthy last week, and he actually wrote a book on this, the difference between project management and product management, and the difference in terms of scope. I remember the way Baz described that product does not have scope, for example. I mean, Bruce would say it's a vehicle with which you change the world kind of thing. But projects, very short-term scope, and most projects aren't that long. And so there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. So this whole kind of long-term value view is quite different. So what's your experience been with execs when they come across this concept of product, when maybe they've historically been talking about projects, even though they do actually have products?
It really depends. It depends. Yeah, I mean, the term project is pretty well bolted into their minds, and they're pretty comfortable with it. Projects, programs, portfolios. The degree of penetration, mental penetration into an average executive's head is really the function of their willingness to actually spend the time to learn. Many executives have done really well for themselves. After all, to sit where they sit and to make what they make, they must have done something right for themselves, right? Let's admit it. But they were, if you think of the way how they got educated, MIT business or something similar, the way they see organizational dynamics with their own eyes, it's probably very different from what they are themselves saying in those very town halls. So adaptiveness and agility isn't really consistent with the way they manage today. So it's not about right or wrong. What they do is probably very right, but for very different system optimizing goals. It is probably right for precision, for accuracy, for illusion of precision, of course, and accuracy, because those reports and metrics that they use, vanity metrics, in my view, are least accurate, but at least they optimize what they know best. But if they decide to optimize for adaptiveness and agility, then of course they need to reconsider what they value and what they stress.
Understood. And that leads us on nicely to my last question for you today, Gene, which is, what can one measure, if anything, to see how adaptiveness is going?
That's a tough one. So first of all, I'm very skeptical in general when it comes to measurements and metrics, because as Einstein said once, I'm paraphrasing, not everything that's easy to measure is meaningful or makes sense, and vice versa. Not everything that is so important to measure is easy to measure. I'm paraphrasing. He did a better job framing this. But I'm not a big fan of vanity metrics, and I'm not a big fan of collecting data for the sake of having numbers, because those are very easy to fudge, very easy to play with. And we see lots of system gaming and numbers collusion in the industry, especially with large organizations where metrics cascade up the chain of command from low to high as they go through various agile tools from layers to layers, L1s, L3s, L5s, L6s. Sevens. By the time it gets to CIO, the picture is peachy. Great. Everything is hunky-dory. We ask a developer, how's the project going? Man, it's just banged out of shape. But how would a CIO know? So that's a long way of telling you that I'm personally skeptical about metrics. What really matters to me is, what can you show me? What have you done? So it's a shippable, it's a potentially shippable product increment in product development. But if we also want to be a little more, I guess, versatile in what we measure, I would look at another few dimensions. For example, I would look at the gradual maturity over time of our own definition of done. Are we improving to expand our own definition of done as a team or as a product group? Or are we still in the same spot, not moving forward at all? So what's the point of me measuring how many times did I go to daily scrum, or even if I had a product backlog refinement or a review, if my definition of done is super immature and I have nothing to deliver at the end of sprint, but the entire spectrum of measurements is shining green, plus you have a product owner, you have a scrum master. Oh, by the way, those are XBAs and XBMs. And you got all these little checks and balances that companies like to have, but you don't have anything meaningful. The other two dimensions that could help us measure agile maturity, if nothing else, would be transaction costs and switching costs running to zero. So the closer they get to zero, the more adaptive we are. Essentially, as an adaptive entity, you want to make sure every time you transact, you don't encounter extra costs. Every time you switch from one effort to another, you don't encounter extra costs. And that would make you more nimble, more adaptive, more responsive. So since we are in agile business, did I say this right? Then of course, this would be a better measure than, did you spend 5 to 10% of your sprint doing backlog refinement? So if I did, nothing good came out of this. Those things are just not effective to measure. And so if you're really trying to do economics on this, then of course, switching costs and transaction costs, economic factors. So you put the economic spin on this. And agility, although agility is not about making things cheaper, you can look at overall economics after a certain period of time, you have become more adaptive and see what you find out.
That was really good, Gene. Thank you so much for coming on the Exagility podcast. Pleasure having you on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you, John. It was a pleasure and an honor to be here. And I really look forward to maybe doing this at some later point. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
If you would like your voice message to be featured on a future podcast episode, please leave a voice message at anchor.fm/xagility/message. That's anchor.fm/xagility/message. Thank you.